Okay, here with Tom for the Midweek Pod. Tom, how's it going? You were just telling me off air that you've got a cold again.
Yeah, so I'm sorry to basically all the listeners that you've got to hear my really nasally voice. My voice is nasally at the best times, so I'm awfully sorry to...
Well, people can't catch it over the internet, I don't think, anyway.
So that's true.
That's all right.
But it's still a lovely sound.
Very true. Well, you want to take yourself some Lemsip and some vitamin C and get yourself better, because there's a big game at the weekend. You want to be up for that?
There is. And yeah, I feel like big games really take a lot of energy out of me as well. If I'm watching it at the ground or watching it in my living room, it's quite an exhausting experience.
Yeah, well, we'll get onto that one. Yes, I think it's going to be an exhausting experience. It actually, recording this midweek pod where we now don't really talk about games because United managed to get themselves knocked out of every competition, is quite kind of nice in a way, because we don't have to talk about United having been beaten.
It's true.
Which is a great segue to talk about Antony. No, I'm kidding.
But also it means that Ten Hag has a week on the training ground with the players to implement
something,
what we usually see at the weekend.
Yeah.
So I feel like, I don't know. Love to know what they do.
Yeah, I'd love to know what they do as well. Yeah. Ten Hag brought in to play the Ajax style, now playing the Mourinho style. Go figure.
It's like an Ollie light, isn't it? He's not quite as good as Ollie, but similar type of football.
Just need Ollie for the vibes. So,
I kind of do think this as well. Like, I was pretty harsh on Ollie, especially towards the end. And I kind of thought, oh, he's not this elite manager. And then, and I know, obviously, like, the interview came out last week, so I'm kind of... And there's a lot of recency bias about how bad Ten Hag's doing and the nostalgia for Ollie and stuff. But it's like, oh, man. It was actually quite fun when he was the manager.
Yeah, it was. And someone you could really get behind as well, whatever his limitations. Yeah. Well, and actually, especially because he was so derided in the media and by opposition fans as being a PE teacher or whatever. That was another reason to get behind him. We are getting kind of Ollie-tinted glasses here, aren't we? But it sometimes feels like it. It's interesting, though. We're going to talk about a bunch of media stories, but one of them that came out this week was actually about Ineos planning with Ten Hag summer transfer strategy and tour. Obviously, there's a fairly extensive US tour, a lot of Premier League clubs over in the States, United playing in LA and San Diego and other spots. I was looking at tickets, astronomical amounts, as they were last summer as well. I mean, yeah, do I really want to spend like $300 to $500 watching United versus Real Betis in San Diego? It's bonkers.
I wonder how long that'll continue as well. Because, I mean, we obviously spoke about it last summer, and then you see all the, like, the people complaining on Twitter and stuff, but people keep buying them, don't they? And people keep going, and they keep selling out these stadiums. So, like, it's going to continue for a little bit, but you just wonder, like, when the turning point will come where, like, people are like, fuck this.
Well, yeah. And because it's mostly US fans, clearly, for these tours, there isn't obviously there are many deep United supporters in the States, but mainly they're aiming at a casual fan audience. And so maybe that's why the pricing's up, because it's a one-off event type thing. I don't know. It like most events here in the US, so whether sporting or concerts, all have dynamic pricing, which I can imagine if they introduce that at Premier League football. I mean, seriously, like the big clubs, United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Spurs, and maybe some others who sell out their capacity at 99 and a bit percent over the season, probably leaving quite a lot of money on the table anyway, despite the kind of range in prices. And some of the season ticket prices at Spurs, they just announced, absolutely astronomical. Obviously, they're having to fund their new stadium. But if you added dynamic pricing in, that would be very interesting. And of course, United have kind of tried to do this under the radar by, well, they deny it, don't they? Kind of reselling tickets at a premium rate and doing a kind of off-site hospitality thing. So you get some kind of buffet in your ticket, and it's now £200 instead of 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it'd go down very well, but sometimes it does surprise me just how much money United have left on the table for all the effort to squeeze blood out of the stone in the early years of the Glazers in the last decade or so. They've mostly frozen ticket prices. Obviously, they went up last summer, but yeah, it is interesting. They haven't gone down that route.
Yeah, I kind of wondered that as well, and it shows that they're not. I don't know. They have almost some heart to them. Like they almost don't. They don't.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
I'm not even sure they're human. Some heart.
Okay, maybe.
All right. Before we get on to some of these media stories, we should talk a little bit, since we talked about finances, about United's finances. I guess it's Q2 results. So there's really nothing to talk about other than the headline debt figure. And Kieran Maguire, who does the Price of Football podcast, excellent podcast if you're into football finance and dad jokes. He did some analysis of United's net debt, which has just topped $1 billion for the first time. Net debt. It's actual corporate debt and the bonds, the revolving credit facility, and the transfers owed minus the cash on hand. £1 billion in debt. And like more than half of that is just over the last 5 years. It's been an absolute shocking rise, partly through the COVID, but also United basically buying players on the tick.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. There we go. We've won a trophy, lads. It's the £1 billion in debt trophy. At least Spurs got a similar debt, but they got a shiny new stadium out of it. And obviously a lot of talk this week as well about the stadium at Old Trafford. Andy Burnham, Mayor of Manchester, Everton supporting Mayor of Manchester, who did a lot of bleating about Everton's point deduction. He's fairly sound, Burnham. Apart from that, I thought that was ridiculous. He went on the Talk of the Devils podcast with Carl Anker and Andy Mitten and Laurie Whitwell to talk a little bit about the regeneration project around Old Trafford. And it seems fairly clear now with this task force, Gary Neville, Seb Coe, Andy Burnham, a few of the Trafford Borough and Salford Borough councillors, the goal number one is brand new stadium with a regeneration of the local area, and they're looking for taxpayer funding or levelling up funding for the kind of general area regeneration.
Yeah, because Gary Neville was speaking about that as well, wasn't he? Because I think some people thought that Gary Neville's business at United was going to be as part of the kind of the football side of things. But I think he spoke about being more excited and more interested in the off-the-field stuff and the regeneration and the property. I think he's really, really into that these days. And he did make some like really good points about how derelict the area is around Old Trafford and how it's just been like that for so long. And then you look at kind of the other side of the city and what the City Football Group have done around Manchester City Stadium and having their little women's stadium that they have and all that kind of stuff. A little bit like if anyone's ever been to the Nou Camp in Barcelona, where they have the stadium, and I think they have the basketball stadium on site and stuff. And it all just makes sense. It's just the decay and the decrepitness around Old Trafford is just another symptom of the Glazer ownership, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Already within 3 or 4 weeks of Radcliffe securing the deal, we've already seen some type of movement, and also it's quite exciting, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. I mean, like we'll see. It seems like the timeline is the next sort of 3, 4, 5 months to make a go no go decision on what the route is, and then after that, it's going to take some time, obviously, for design and planning and planning permission and legal challenges and finance and all of that kind of stuff. And it's the financing for the stadium can be separate, so you can just finance the property. But a lot of United's current debt is leveraged against Old Trafford, so some of that would have to be cleared, I imagine, or refinanced in some other way. So it's leveraged against United's assets, of which Old Trafford is part of it, and also the shares. So if the covenants in those bonds aren't met, the bondholders or the debt providers can claw back those assets. So that's very typical. Of course, Radcliffe, Ineos, Trawlers Limited, all rich enough just to clear out that debt if they want. I suspect what we'll see is a refinancing, because interest rates are high, but in the second half of this year, I think most economists are predicting they'll come down. That may release some more debt, and it may make sense to refinance at that point. I would be fairly comfortable with that. That doesn't actually cost United that much, sort of 20 million-ish. Of course, that's 20 million that could be spent on players. So it'd be better completely debt-free, but I'd imagine just for cash purposes that would be the route. Same with the new stadium. If and when that happens, it's going to be a very long-term project, though. I wouldn't expect the cranes to be coming into Gore anytime soon, but at some point. But yes, that is an exciting project. We saw what happened over the Keys in Salford Keys and Media City. I mean, it's fantastic space now. Definitely wasn't in the 90s. And I guess a lot of that development kind of happened through that period into the 2000s. So, yeah, much as City Group and their state-sponsored partners have regenerated a lot of East Manchester, then it's time for the West Side to be regenerated too.
It'd be very interesting to see how it looks practically when the new stadium is being built. Like, where do we go for that period of time?
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's a brand new stadium, they've got plenty of land there. I mean, there may have to be something done with that freight terminal, so it will impact.
Sorry,
that.
I meant as in when the stadium's being built. Like, where do we play? Like, where do we play our games?
Well, Old Trafford, I guess. I mean, because it'd be on the same footprint. It's a kind of, they own a lot of land, but the main part of it's a kind of triangle wedge in between the Bridgewater Canal and the Manchester Ship Canal. The Bridgewater Canal and the railway line. And so some of it is car park now. But in order to have the space to develop, I imagine something has to be done with that freight terminal. I think United own that land on which the freight terminal sits. So whether it has to be moved or something like that when there's redevelopment, we'll see in due course what the plans are. But I expect come the summer, we'll get some interesting developments on that one. All right. Well, talking of the summer, United are going to try and ship out a bunch of players, and there's a few of them to talk about, I think. So a few stories out this week. Obviously, Mason Mount is fit again. He has played just 12 games all season. There's a piece in the Daily Mail and the Manchester Evening News, can't remember which way round it came, basically saying, well, it was a fairly critical piece by Luckhurst, wasn't it? Talking about, like, kind of snarky about Mason Mount's transfer and suggesting it wasn't really to do with football and, I guess, to do with money because his contract was running down. Bit odd.
Yeah, I think that the article also, I mean, yeah, Samuel Luckhurst snarky is, well, yeah. But, like, he kind of mentioned that Arsenal and Liverpool were after him and other teams, but were they really? Like, why would Liverpool be after him, or why would Arsenal? I don't really get that, to be honest. Like, he's an okay footballer, but, like, I don't think there was that many options available for him, and Chelsea wanted him out, like, because of that stupid FFP rule where obviously all the profit just goes to sort that problem out. It's like, and then obviously the article mentioned about how, like, Chelsea fans are getting on his back, calling him a money grabbing wanker and stuff, like, which is obviously just really harsh, because, like, in the same way, Gallagher is probably going to be pushed out of Chelsea this season. Like, Mount was pushed out, I guess not against his will, but, like, at least given a little sort of nudge, like, come on, you're going to do us a favour if you get out. I can understand, like, why people might say that he's gone to United not for football reasons. I think there's been so many footballers down the years. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's not a bright idea, really, to join United at this stage of your career. Yeah. At this stage of the United, of what we are. Like, when Solskjaer was talking about Bellingham last week, Bellingham knew what he wanted, and it wasn't United. And I guess, yeah, you could say that about any player. Like, if they're going to join a football club, why would they join United, type of thing? But it's weird to kind of put a hit piece out on Mount, especially, like, as he's had real struggles this season. One, with injuries, and also two, when he's played in a position that he's not comfortable with, which is not his fault in any respect.
I don't know what position he is comfortable in, though. I mean, I think it's part of the problem with buying him. Like, no one really had an idea.
Well, it's true, yeah. I guess you would play him behind the, well, in Bruno's position, really, wouldn't you?
Or a floating eight, yeah. Interesting to see if he's back in the squad this weekend, given that we've seen a bunch of pictures of him training. And he's obviously been out for a very long time. So we'll see if Ten Hag wants to push him. But maybe he's in the squad and gets a few minutes in the cup. There's not that many games to go this season for him to, well, for a couple of reasons, him to just get back and playing and fit again. And then I suppose if he played really well towards the end of the season, he could start to push for a place in the England squad, although I'd be surprised. Southgate seemed to love him at one stage and then suddenly dropped him before he went to United and he didn't feature anymore. So he's got a lot to prove. I mean, I don't blame him. I mean, Chelsea will fail FFP, and I think most analysts of this are pretty sure about it until they make some sales. And obviously, the academy players are on the books at zero value, so it's all booked as profit. So for FFP purposes, that's the reason. There's not some magical accounting thing. It's just, and it will catch up with you. You've got to keep selling. It's not like a magic money tree that creates more cash than any other kind of player sale. It's just on the books straight away. And there's no amortization charge or impairment charges or anything like that. So that's why Chelsea may push out Gallagher this summer. It's an easy one to try and balance the FFP books.
I think the thing with Mount is, like, coming back to United, it's like, I wonder how many United fans are actually excited about him coming back from injury, because it's not like, well, he is a new signing last summer and he's wearing number 7 and he came in for a lot of money. But he was one of the least exciting like tens of millions. So what was he, 60?
Yeah, 55 plus 5, I think.
Yeah, 60 million signings, like one of the least exciting ones I can remember. And him coming back from injury, it's like, does he really improve the team? Are we going to get excited about what he's going to offer United? And I can't imagine, I'm certainly not excited, and I can't imagine too many United fans are excited about coming back either. He'll be a good player to have around the squad and stuff, but he just feels like a similar type of player to Eriksen, really. Like, they're kind of similar.
Almost forgotten Eriksen exists. Has he played recently?
Yeah. I saw the Denmark manager was saying that he needs to get playing for them so he can be a help for them in the Euros in the summer. And where it's like, oh, yeah. She forgot he was
that one. He exists. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that if you think about the players we were just going to talk about in this block, Mount, Greenwood, Antony. I mean, between Antony and Mount, there's £120 million of spending there. More £140 million. Mm-hmm. And then perhaps if we move on to Greenwood, John Murta and Matt Hargreaves were spotted in Barcelona this week. I mean, internet went wild with speculation that they're trying to sell him to Barcelona. And Barcelona are in a tight financial spot. It looks like their La Liga cap will be pretty low, so they're more like selling players rather than buying them. But there's obviously a lot of talk about Greenwood, because I think their decision will be they're going to try and sell him for whatever they can get. He's done okay at Getafe. I don't think brilliantly. He scored at the weekend, though, didn't he?
Yeah, so, I've watched a little bit of him, and he obviously came back so talented. I kind of, in some respects, wondered how good he would come back, because he'd been out of not playing for, 18 months or so. But he does still have that raw ability, that pace, like just the ability to go on both feet. I don't want to kind of talk about like lording too much or anything, but in purely footballing terms, like, he actually hasn't been that good. And Mayoral, it's not, you can't just say, oh yeah, it's Getafe, then you'd expect him to only have 3 goals and 4 assists or whatever it is this season. It's similar types of numbers to that. But Mayoral in that side has
scored quite a lot. He's injured now.
Maybe fourth top scorer at top.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. When I'd seen Greenwood this season, he played off the right in a 4-4-2. Right, so not even sort of off the right in a 4-3-3. So I think that there's probably some caveats around the raw numbers there in terms of as goals and assists, just he's playing in a slightly weird position. But, I mean, he's too good for that team. And United will be an interesting like quandary this summer. He's obviously a toxic asset. They're not going to keep him. I just can't see a scenario, despite Ratcliffe sort of hedging the answer then when asked a few weeks ago. So the fee that they'll get from him will be nowhere near the one they could have got for him on the open market if he was playing as he was 2 years ago. I think that's just well accepted. And he can't really be sold to an English club. Oh, he could be, but it'd be hard for anyone to do it. So, and there just aren't the level outside of Real Madrid. There's no money anywhere in Europe, basically. So it's not going to be a huge fee, I suspect, in the end. And there was also that rumor of Tafe having a 20% sell on as part of the sweetener. I don't know how true that is. I mean, nothing would surprise me. Nothing would surprise me in the kind of incompetence United have shown in the market. Anyway, because Ashworth is not, the deal signed Ashworth from Newcastle has not been agreed yet, and I guess they're haggling over fee and start date for him. It seems like the usual crowd executing on United's summer plans, which I think should worry us, because they're going to sell Greenwood for 10 quid and some magic beans or something.
I mean, yeah, in an ideal world, like he'd have scored like 20 goals this season and ripped it up every single game he played. But, and then you could, yeah, you could maybe
well,
say.
Well, in an ideal like world, he might million. Be in, like, in strange ways, like
well, that
on
is
the
true,
roof
yeah.
protesting about the conditions, because, yeah, that might that be the true. Ideal world. Some people would that say, no, not judge and jury here. But yes, the next ideal world is United flogging for as much as possible and he's someone else's problem. Although, even then, yeah. I think. You know, the weird thing about, I don't know, that's not the right phrasing. It's not the weird thing. The thing about sending him abroad is that the woman he allegedly abused, who said he abused her, is now away from friends and family with an alleged abuser. You know, I couldn't help but think about that, the kind of extra vulnerability that she was placed in because of United's decision there. I don't know there was a winning solution. It's just something to consider.
It's got to a point now, though, that's it's not irrelevant, but it's just it's too far gone. Like there's no coming back now. As soon as Getafe kind of were willing to lay down all their morals, I think they're basically Andrew Tate FC anyway, aren't they?
Like yes,
it was game over, and like the La Liga president the other week saying he's an asset to the league, and then the Jamaica manager the other day saying like, oh yeah, we'd like to have him in our squad. Like it's way too far gone. Like there are going to be suitors out there in Europe for him, like across the continent. Like you say, maybe not in England, because I think he's too toxic for sponsors and probably some fans to tolerate, but across the continent he'll be sought after. I mean, you're thinking, like, I guess Turkey put up a lot of money sometimes for players. Like, would he maybe go to Fenerbahce or Besiktas or Galatasaray, one of those three? And yeah, or somewhere like Italy, like Juventus or Inter. But like you say, there's not that much money swirling around.
There isn't, yeah. All right, the other player that I think United would be happy to offload, but will have a lot of trouble offloading, is Antony. So two reasons why they'd have a lot of trouble offloading him. They would have to take an impairment charge because there's not a hope in hell. So like, let's say he was, what, 80 million, 80 and a bit million, 95 million euros. So let's call it 80 and a bit million across 5 years. So it's, what, 17 million a year on the amortization. We've had 2 years of him. So his book value is probably in the 50-ish. Yeah, I aren't going to get 50 million for Antony now, so there would be an impairment. So that's one reason why it's hard to sell him. He's obviously going to be on a mega contract, because we love to hand out mega contracts to average players. It's our thing. So that's another reason why it would be hard to sell him. And the third reason, Peace and Telegraph today saying that the police investigation into the two women who accused him of abusing them, of hitting them, has not been concluded in Brazil. And obviously, other clubs would be reluctant to take him on until that has been concluded, just in case he's found guilty and there's an arrest warrant out for him. Awesome. Football in 2024.
I feel like we might be Andrew Tate FC, actually.
Yeah, we might be. Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at Richard Arnold before he departed, RIP, and Eric Ten Hag seemed to be quite happy to have these players around. No questions asked. Yeah.
there's a theme going on.
Talking of which, did you see Ryan Giggs is now working as director of football at Salford? Ryan Giggs, who was acquitted of all charges against him, I should say.
Unbelievable that they would do that. I mean, Gary Neville is something. I mean, he always talks such a good game, doesn't he? But there's so many holes to almost like everything that he does, in my opinion. Yeah. And there's so much contradictory, like hypocriticalness to almost everything he says as well. Like the way he talks, he used to talk about how like football clubs are so quick to put the boot in on managers, and then like Salford like used to sack their manager like every 2 or 3 months. And yeah, to do this is nothing short of disgraceful, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's only fair of us to say he was not convicted. Although I would say it was not a good look what was coming out in the reporting of that particular case too. So yes, I mean, he's not in prison. He wasn't convicted. He's free to be employed. And employers, well, do that at your own risk, I guess. But yeah, we've always said, haven't we, that it's not just about, that's not the bar, is it, for employment in football? Like the club should, given their place in society, they owe the fans and the fellow employees more than that.
And you can understand it more if just a random club went for it. But when it's your mate, it's such a bad look. It's such a bad look when it's just your pal who's you're given a job because he can't get a job anywhere else.
Yeah, quite.
Jobs for the boys, like, come on, talk about like white privilege and all that kind of stuff that we've talked about over and over again. Like, it's, yeah, to me, it's just disgraceful. I mean, sure, like some people probably disagree and say like, oh, everyone deserves a second chance or whatever. But like the second chances, and we've said it before, like the second chance in football, and such a job like that, just like I say, jobs for the boys. It's ridiculous.
Yes. And since we're on Gary Neville, the Premier League has not agreed a finance deal with the EFL. This is in the shadow of the football regulator that's about to come in. They're advertising for staff for the football regulator before the bill's actually been signed into law. But it looks like that white paper might be coming forth as a bill before the end of this parliamentary session. So we'll get a football regulator. And if the Premier League and the EFL don't agree a deal, then the regulator may push it through anyway. So, and I say talking about Gary Neville because he's been one of the most vocal EFL owners asking for more money from the Premier League. And the Premier League are pushing back. And I guess they're pushing back for two reasons. One is there's 10 clubs apparently do not agree with the size of the deal. But there's also a bunch of conditions that have been put on there, both about sort of financial regulation. So if you're going to have this handout, we're going to dictate how you can spend money. But also like stuff around the edges that has happened in the past when they've struck deals about kind of player sales and academy sales and stuff like that. So, but basically it's the headline number, I think. One Premier League chairman was quoted, not named, but quoted, I saw in a piece saying we'll have to borrow money to do this because most Premier League clubs are loss making despite their top line revenue. Anyway, I'd be fine personally. Like, I'm a fan of a Premier League club, so the more money United have, the better, I suppose. Not that we're very good at spending it, but I'm totally fine with whatever number they come up with because the sustainability of football in the country is more important than like an extra 10 million a year or whatever it's going to cost United. But like, and I don't mean this in a kind of arrogant way, there has to be cost controls. Because otherwise, just like prune juice, if you look at the Championship, like almost all the clubs are spending more than 100% of income on wages, right? So owners having to finance or debtors having to finance the rest. I just did a back of the envelope calculation on Salford, and I think they're at more than 90% and they made a huge loss. Right, as well, because all the cost of operations. So, like, yeah, Gary Neville's always argued that owners should be able to pump in as much financing as they want. At the same time, asking for more money for the Premier League, and at the same time, not meeting any cost controls. I just don't see how all these things come together.
The problem is, just to be really simple and reductive about it. The problem is just inequality, because the reason why every championship club is spending 100% on wages is because that is the promised land to get into the Premier League, and that's where all the money is. And that's why there's such a huge disparity between the clubs in the championship and the clubs in the Premier League. Look at the three teams that came up in the Premier League to the Premier League this season. They're all fucking shit, and they're all going to pretty much go back down unless Luton do something miraculous.
Right, and Leeds and Leicester look like they're going to come straight back up, and
probably Southampton as well. Like And the problem is that all these clubs are bankrupting themselves in the championship because they're seeing how much money is in the Premier League and through the television broadcasts and obviously the stadiums that are going to fill out every year. And that's why so many foreign owners are coming into the championship, because they're seeing, oh my God,
the promise. Exactly.
And then you get all the managers as well. Like, there's such great level of managers now in the championship because they're being paid like great wages, and the players are being great wages to get into the Premier League. But then what happens when that chairman has enough, or they can't work their way into the Premier League?
What happens is Derby County.
And Reading and potentially what will happen at Forest if Marinakis pulled out.
Decided to go away, yeah.
And so many football clubs, even before that, like Portsmouth and Bolton, it's been this way for so long, and it's just getting worse and worse because of the inequality.
Yeah. Well, the two things that really skew things are the parachute payments, which were brought in to kind of smooth out the cliff. So you've got a bunch of players on Premier League wages. You get relegated, you can't just flog them. Or you tried to flog them, but you still owe them those wages, right? So the parachute payments are there to smooth out the cliff, but then they're completely distorting in the championship, and those parachute payments are bigger than the revenue of every other club, basically. So the perfect system would be to have this smooth glide slope from first in the Premier League down to the bottom club in League Two of distribution of money, but there's no incentive for the Premier League to do that, and that would make them less competitive in European terms. So it's very hard to get 14 Premier League clubs to agree to that kind of deal. That would stop all the inequality alongside tight financial controls. Now, we are getting tighter financial controls in Europe with the squad cost rule. It looks like we're going to get something like that in the Premier League too. They're going to match Europe. And so maybe in 24, 25 or 25, 26, we'll have a 70% squad cost rule. Something like that. If they implemented something similar in the championship, it would go a very long way to creating sustainability, I think. But of course, like, not all the actors line up, right? You've got ambitious owners, you've got desperate owners, and you've got players who don't want to see their wages capped in some way, which a squad cost rule effectively does, not on an individual level, but on a squad level. And so, like, all these different bodies don't align with what's necessarily best for the game.
It will soon create a real chasm between League One and the Championship as well, if that's not being created already. Because
because the proposal on distribution is like 90% of the funds go to the Championship.
You already see it kind of sometimes with like Rotherham, for example, getting absolutely battered in League One, and Huddersfield, I think, have been a lot more frugal than a lot of other teams in the Championship since they got relegated back into the Championship with their parachute payments, and they're not spending huge amounts of money on wages and managers and stuff. And they're struggling, and they're almost struggling because they're being sensible, and which is ridiculous.
Yeah, right. That's it.
Yeah. And then you get the knock-on effect of that, of what it has on the fans, because they're kind of like screaming at the chairman and the manager for not having any kind of ambition. And it's just, there's so many kind of vicious cycles that come from the inequality that just exists.
All right, that's finances. Jolly good. A couple of other media things before we move on to previewing United 0 Liverpool 7 at the weekend, whatever it's going to be. I'm joking about that, by the way. Definitely won't be 7-0. Touch wood. We had a couple of weird things. One, Goldbridge on the United Stan channel called Andy Mitten jealous And there was a significant amount of pushback online about that particular framing, which rightly so, I'd say. Andy Mitten is one of the most respected fans / journalists. Started the fanzine, Night We Stand, when he was like 16 or something. It's been, and that's super tough, right? Getting enough people interested to buy it and editing it. And it's a really good magazine that covers football and culture, and just respected for his journalism and his appearances on the Talk of the Devils podcast, where he does like to go on about his anecdotes rather a lot. But hey, we're giving that. And then, yeah, contrasting Goldbridge, who his channel has deliberately, let's be honest, deliberately started pylons on a number of players. And, you know, in game, I think he called one United player a cunt, quote unquote, recently. And I'd been told by someone else that there was a lot of unhappiness about the fact that United Stand had been given access by the club to players. This is about social reach, not about player needs. And so, yes, I wonder whether there won't be a fairly substantial rethink about that.
I was, when you were kind of talking there, I was thinking that in terms of journalism terms, like, who could Andy Mitten be jealous of, really? Like, he's got it all, really. Like, as I saw someone say on Twitter, like, he's respected in the director's box and he's also respected in the stands. Like, he's got that two-way thing where, like, he's respected by all. I'm sure there's definitely United fans out there who probably don't like him because you're not loved by everyone. But, like, he must have so much respect from such a huge swath of United fans. And quite rightly, like you say, like, he does like an anecdote. He only likes to tell them in some length. But, like, yeah, you can't knock him for anything that he's achieved. And especially in terms of, like, people covering United, he's got the life, hasn't he? Like, he goes to pretty much every single away game and every single home game across Europe. And, yeah, covers United in depth for The Athletic. And yeah, he's got, I guess, what many of us. I think there must be a lot of United fans who are jealous of the job that he has, because almost like every United fan's dream. If you're not playing for the team, you want to be doing something that he's doing, really. And then for Goldbridge, which is like, I mean, he has a lot of subscribers and he probably makes a lot of money, but that's basically it. Like, he has a lot of people to speak to, but he must be, I feel like it's just must be one of the most soulless jobs to have, really, because you must know, like, in your heart of hearts, you're not speaking the truth. You're not speaking with any integrity especially in relation to what Andy Mitten would be doing. It feels very much him, whereas Goldbridge is just a character. Like, rumors that he's actually a Forest fan, and, like, it's all so soulless, his work, and it's bullshit. And we've spoken about it before of how it's actually quite damaging to the ecosystem of society, not just United fandom.
Yeah,
it's grim, and it's,
I think it's
hilarious.
Very toxic. Yes. It used to be kind of amusing. I'd never spent a lot of time watching his stuff, but obviously it's clipped for socials and people send it around the key points. And I guess there was some kind of car crash amusement to it, so in the similar way to Arsenal Fan TV.
Yeah.
Used to be sort of car crash, and you can see why that kind of stuff appeals. I think the toxicity of sort of, like, driving and forming opinion, especially amongst online Reds, of what to think about players is not helpful. And obviously they kind of came out in support of the Qatar bid. Now, I don't know exactly why that happened, whether they were just big fans of the Qataris and the potential for their ownership, or whether they were furnished with some sponsorship money by one of the many PR firms employed by the Qataris through the World Cup and through the bid process. Who knows? Make your own decision on that one. But Goldbridge basically said the club was finished and he was no longer going to be a United fan if Ratcliffe completed his bid. And here he is still shitting on players on a daily basis. So anyway, I kind of thought the pushback from so many fans with a kind of timely comeuppance, and I hope the club think about how they differentiate between fan media, because we do want the club to like reach out to fan media, I think, and fan groups and news. And I think they've kind of slipped into the second category incorrectly. And the comms department might want to think about that. I know some people from United listen to this show, so have a word with yourselves, fellas. All right. Oh, yeah. No. Before we move on to Liverpool, Carragher Abdo.
Oh, no.
On CBS, which has become, the coverage there is like heavy banter, basically.
It is, yeah.
And it's really grating, I have to say. But some people like that, and that's their decision to kind of do the bantorious coverage. But Carragher being a bit weird, seemingly suggesting that she cheated on her fiance.
Carragher's role in that show is, I don't watch it that often. I sometimes do watch it. And obviously I see it clipped all the time because it's such viral content, so much stuff. And I guess that's the reason why they created a show like that.
That's a point.
But like Carragher's role in that four, I guess, with Kate Abdo as well. It's just a shout loud. Like he's just shouting, isn't he? That's kind of what like Micah Richards does all the time. But Micah Richards got that charisma, he's funny, like he's got a good laugh. I mean, he's obviously a City fan. But he's just a lovable bloke. Whereas Carragher, he's just so try hard in that show. Like Thierry's got like the coolness, and he's obviously a very pretentious man, but like, yeah, he's Thierry Henry. I guess he can get away with being pretentious when you're as good and smooth as he was. But like, yeah, he's so annoying in that show, Carragher. Like, I actually like him on M&F. Like, he goes into some depth. I think he's also quite pretentious in the way he talks, but he does get, especially when like guests were on, like Ian Wright was on Monday, and he was really good. Yeah. Like, he really facilitates a great show on M&F. But he's so great on that show. And you could tell immediately that he knew he'd fucked up with that Kate Abdo comment because, well, Michael Richard looks to the floor. Henri kind of says, like, sorry, like, what? And then Carragher, because he's such a juvenile, just carries on laughing. It's like, ha, ha, ha. It's just being this loud, weird, incongruent self that he's created on this show.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's... There's obviously been loads of pushback today. Like even Richard Keys was getting his aura out, which is
well, and Richard Keys, wow,
he was like, "No way, someone's done the same as me."
And yeah, it is very odd because Carragher has these two different characters.
They are literally two different characters. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, and it's clearly a production choice. They don't do a lot of analysis. They have a lot of adverts. It's CBS coverage of Champions League or Paramount Plus coverage in the US. And they've decided not to be serious as a production ethos. It's just kind of laugh and banter, and they over laugh at crap jokes and all of that. And that's Micah Richards' thing. And as you say, Carragher does a lot of shouting, and Kate Abdo sort of, and they have weird segments. I've had weird segments in the past where they like interview their parents and stuff like that. And I'm just like, what's the point? And just tune in 2 minutes before the game and just watch the coverage instead. So it is very odd coverage overall anyway. But like within that, it's kind of pushing them to be more and more viral oriented. So they can clip the stuff, viral content to drive social engagement and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I don't think it's great. I do worry that like a lot of coverage seems to be pushing that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And even the kind of color commentary for the co-coms, sometimes they have two. So there've been matches where they've had three co-commentators, and that's pretty weird as well. And you're just kind of relieved when there's a bit more downbeat, just talking about the football.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you get that more on NBC is more serious here in the US. Anyway, the NBC coverage, Peacock coverage is more serious.
I think that point you make is really good about him being two characters, whereas I think like the shouty Carragher is just not him at all. Whereas I think with like Micah Richards and Henri on the show, that they are like versions of themselves. Like they're amplified because they're being told to be a certain way. But Carragher it's so incongruent. It's so inauthentic that it just comes across like, what are you doing? Like, you just, like, at least with like Henri and Micah, they're kind of, like I say, versions of themselves. Whereas Carragher's just a different bloke. And he's, yeah. And I'm not surprised that this came eventually, because I'm not going to say that that's his character, that this eventually came out, that this, he would make such a crude joke like this. But like, we've seen it before, like obviously the spitting incident, which is just, it's still mad that he got away with that. And it's still mad that he even did it, and so mad that he got wound up by it so much. And there's also that clip where, I think it was at Forest, where like he grabbed someone's phone who was taking a photo of him. And it's like, yeah, he has a real problem like keeping his emotions in check, and he clearly did it the other night to like let out such a crazily sexist comment.
Yeah. Well,
on,
I mean,
on live TV.
Anyone who hasn't seen that, it's all over the social, so you'll be able to get it fairly easy. I have an anecdote about Thierry Henry, which I'm not going to tell. I don't think I've told it on this podcast, because it is a family audience and it's very X-rated. I will let you know afterwards. It's a good one, though. All right, let's move on. Liverpool at the weekend. It looks like there'll be some players back, though. Maybe not the key ones. I mean, I don't think Lisandro Martinez will be back, although it looks like it's not much longer. Luke Shaw, definitely not. Tyrell Malacia, RIP Tyrell Malacia.
Yeah.
We haven't seen him ever. I mean, he's sleeping with the fishes alongside the Duchess of Windsor, or whatever she's called. Secretly not alive, yeah. Kim Jong-un, when he hasn't been seen for months. All very funny. But they're not back. But it looks like Mount will probably be in the squad. And maybe even Rasmus Højlund, although that is unclear. Again, I guess we'll get more on Friday in Ten Hag's presser.
I would be genuinely confident if we had Martinez and Shaw that we win this game. But I think with the injuries that we've got and the back four that we're going to have, we're going to have a little bit of trouble, especially now that they've got Salah and Nunes back. That is big. I still don't think I'm not eternally pessimistic about this game at all. I still think we've got a reasonably decent chance. When we're at home against any big club, I still think we've got a chance, because we've got the players, we've got the individual quality to hurt teams, and we've always done that. Like, even away under Ollie, like, we had some amazing results. And I still think all it takes is like a rash for an early goal and the crowd getting massively behind us. And
yeah.
And they're not that good, in my opinion. I really don't think they are. Like, they've had a lot of luck this season, winning games late after not playing well. Like, they were good in the second half against City. That's probably the best I've seen them all year. But City got rattled. Like, they got really rattled. They didn't play their normal football. Like, the reason why, obviously, Pep took De Bruyne off was because they kept toiling over the ball all the time. And then Kovacic came on and he kept the ball nicely. But Liverpool are a different beast when they play at home.
And
maybe that doesn't come across in like the stats, but they really are. Like, they will dominate teams at home, or they will frighten teams at home, spook teams at home. But away from home, like they can be got at. And they're also quite flat a lot of the time. And
it'd be interesting, won't it, whether we get that kind of high energy that they had in that second half against City. That's the highest energy I've seen them for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, admittedly, I don't watch every game, but they were intense.
Yeah.
And that City had a lot of trouble with that. We would definitely have a lot of trouble with that.
Oh, God, yeah.
Given who's likely to be in the back four, we're not going to move the ball quickly.
No.
Yeah. So that I'm worried about that, us turning over the ball in our defensive third, their attacking third, for sure. I'm worried about the amount of possession. Liverpool had more possession than City. I suspect Eric, he's kind of talked himself into playing this false nine system with Bruno, who he did all right at the weekend there. Like, at least it helps Garnacho and Rashford get into the game.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get a lot of the ball, but can we get enough ball in midfield in order to do that? I'm a little bit worried about the balance with Casemiro and Kobbie Mainoo. I thought it would be better, honestly, but actually I think Mainoo's getting on the ball much less. I mean, he didn't get the ball much at all at the weekend.
Just Casemiro kept passing it to them every time he got it.
Well, that's true. He gave the ball away 13 times, I think it was. It was a really extraordinarily sloppy. I'd actually like to see them swap. I think eventually Mainoo is not going to be a number six. He's got more of a game than that, but I'd kind of like, given that he's got the legs, I'd like to see him as the deeper player and Casemiro push forward just for a pragmatic reasons, honestly.
It's just also got the legs, but he's also got the quality. He's much better on the ball than Casemiro is.
Yeah. Much better. Yeah, talk about Kobbie Mainoo being in the England under-21s. By the time this is out, it's probably going to have been announced that he'll be in the 21s, not the full squad. Which is kind of a shame in a way, because I'd like to see Southgate have a look at him because he's got such quality.
I think that's stupid, to be honest. Like, I don't know if Mainoo's the right player to start for England in the Euros, but in the World Cup, no, it's not Euros, in the Euros in the summer. But if you look at England's balance, he would be the perfect player for that three, the player to play alongside Rice and
Bellingham. Because Henderson's was playing in Saudi and now in the Dutch league, so not at the highest level, and he's old. Calvin Phillips is shit.
and maybe, like I say, maybe he's not the right player to play from the start in the Euros, but you have to have him in this squad. You have to have him in this squad to get to see him on the training pitch, in the games. Does he have it about him to play for England? Is he going to be the perfect player to play for England in the Euros? Because what if, he gets in the under-21 squad and then he has an unbelievable 2 or 3 months for United. Well, 2 months, I guess, now that's left for United towards the end of the season. And then what, are you going to put him straight into the squad then? Or are you just going to leave him out because you're not going to put him in the squad? He has to be in this squad. He has to be in this squad, like, because of how important that position is in the Euros. And like you say, how few players fit into that England team in that position.
Well, I mean, he'll definitely start the weekend against Liverpool. So big game for him to get even more exposure. And yeah, we'll see what the balance of that midfield looks like. I suspect, given it's Ten Hag, that we'll see something very, very similar to what we have in the last few games. So back four of Dalot, Varane, Evans and Lindelof at left back, and Mainoo, Casemiro, Bruno midfield, Garnacho, Rashford. Does that make 10 or 11 players?
McTominay
is the kind of number 10 behind Bruno, yeah. I don't love the balance there. It at least made United a bit more compact. It just for 60 minutes against City.
You just think, though, like how many of those players look after the ball?
And not many. Yes, Mainoo. Right. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, maybe Johnny Evans and Dalot.
Yeah, and you want to get Mainoo on the ball, and he's just, I mean, like Sebastian Groves at Brighton will do 120 passes in the game, and Mainoo's getting on the ball a third less.
Yeah,
because we don't have the ball.
It's also because so many of our players just give the ball away. Like, and for some reason, sometimes it's because they're doing something inventive or they're trying to create something, fine. But in a game like this, especially if Liverpool presses with the intensity that they did, you have to do what City did at the weekend and keep hold of the ball and take the sting out of the game. And with that team that we just went through, we're not going to be able to do that. And I guess there's not much else we can do, to be honest, because there's not a heap of options on the bench being like, oh, that guy will keep the ball better than that guy. Like, yeah.
No, right. That's right. And it's definitely the concern. And the fact that United regularly give up over 20 shots. It's 23 against Everton the weekend. Now, Ten Hag's argument was that there were low-quality shots, which was true to some extent. What I would say is if you give up 20 shots against Liverpool, they're going to score a couple, because obviously in Salah and Diaz, two excellent finishers. Nunes, a bit flakier. But if you give him 6 shots, he might score one. Yeah. So anyway, it's going to catch up with United. Karl Anka did a piece in The Athletic saying, well, maybe it doesn't matter. And basically the argument was that United are doing good box defending, because in Evans and Varane, they do have two very good box defenders.
Yeah.
And as a result, a lot of the chances are sort of long-range shots or not high quality. I wouldn't bet on that strategy against Liverpool more than I'd bet on it against City the other week.
I think there's a couple of things. I wonder if teams, especially because early in the season, Onana was letting so much through them, teams get close to the box and think, oh, we'll just have a pop because the keeper might let one through his hands or whatever. But also, it's not a good sign that teams are getting that close to our box so often that they can have 20 shots. Especially at home against Everton, we should be controlling the game so much better that teams don't get within a sniff of our box. And doesn't matter if they're low quality shots or not. Like you say, Liverpool have the same amount of shots, they'll score 4 or 5 or 6, and it'll be embarrassing.
Yeah.
Again,
please, just sick of it. I'm sick of having to decide between two forms of devil for who's going to win the title. Is it Liverpool or City? Both City 4 in a row. Dan and I were talking on the last pod, and I've felt this way for some time, that I can just kind of rationalize it as cheating.
Synthetic.
And it's hard to rationalize. Hard to rationalize Liverpool at all, because they are a pretty well-run club with actually a very good manager, even if he's a bit of a twat sometimes.
It's so annoying.
He really is, yeah. I'll be glad to see the back of him, honestly, and hopefully Liverpool crumble and it's a couple of decades before they win the title again. But that's for next season, yeah. And I definitely don't want to see Klopp give him some parade. I'd like him to leave.
Gosh.
The greatest manager ever to have played the game, invented tactics, TM, having won one Premier League title in 9 seasons. I think that would be a fitting send-off for him. But versus City, versus Arsenal and Mikel Arteta, who this week, by the way, apparently said some really rude stuff about the Porto manager's family to the Porto manager, who had to remind him his parents are no longer alive.
But then Kamsay Sal has got previous saying that Pep did the same. And maybe I saw a great comp, I think, and someone else he'd accused of before, I can't remember who it was, but there was a great comment on the Athletic piece about the report. It was when multiple people think you're the idiot, maybe you're the idiot. No, when you think multiple people are the idiot, then maybe you're the idiot. And I was okay, maybe it is actually Conte Sal who's in the wrong here.
Yeah.
He's getting help. But
I'm happy to believe that Mikel Arteta is a little shit, because he kind of comes across like that, yeah. So anyway, he's a little shit and annoying, and he wears ridiculously tight trousers and his hair's wrong. And Arsenal fans are the most annoying fans on the planet. They just are. And so I wish them nothing but ill, except in this title race.
Yes.
Anyway, enough of that. Come on, United, at the weekend. Our season will effectively end on Sunday if we lose, because what else we got look forward to? Europa or Conference League qualification. Great stuff. Fantastic.
Lovely.
So, all right, everybody, thank you very much. Go to youtube.com/NQATpod if you want to see this with our lovely faces in video. If you're already there, thank you very much for supporting our small but growing channel, patreon.com/NQATpod for our extra bonus shows, which we do once a week. And we're going to add a tactics pod with a special guest coming up from next week. And you may see more of us on the YouTube channel. I think we're going to do short daily pods a couple of times a week as well, just for YouTube viewers. Yeah, family of content. We're catching up with you, Goldbridge. Coming for you. All right. Thanks a lot, everyone. Bye now.